As a kid, I did stuff like that because you have nothing to lose when you're a kid, except you know maybe you slide off and get hurt. But nowadays, I wouldn't play with that idea. But perhaps paying for a line to be installed and actually paying for the service on it for some minimal period of time, and then having that line disconnected might be the play. I don't mind spending a few bucks. I don't even mind spending a couple of $100 because if it saves me the trouble and danger of climbing up high, to me it's worth it. If I get a good antenna, then it's worth a couple of $100. I think that would be worth a couple of $100 to just about any HF amateur. So I'll see if I can do that. You know, I'll have somebody claim that you know, that they're going to rent space for me, and they have to get their own drop, because I wouldn't want them on my drop. And we'll see if it works.
That's got a lot of merit. Are you possibly a person who has decided that the cell phone service is so good, you're no longer using the wired service, you've terminated the wired service, and I wonder where they do the disconnect? I'm a little bit afraid that the wired service goes into a great big terminal box of some kind. You don't see a really completely separate wire, you know, dangling from the top of the utility pole, so to speak. So internal to their great big terminal box with a whole bunch of screws inside is where they actually open up the circuit. As such, you wouldn't want to power RF into that because it would be going in everybody else's active telephone circuit. But are you possibly one of these guys who is so pleased with wireless service that you've disconnected wired service? I'll bet you haven't. Over to you, Alan.
Comment.
Let me see if I have it. Yeah, I wouldn't really. I was half joking, shooting down the pipeline, and for that very reason, I always envision the phone company using something like an industrial 4067 or 4066 to do their switching, and I imagine if I pump some like 100 watts down there, that might be enough to blow it. So I wouldn't really entertain that idea. But I got rid of my POTS line years ago when Cablevision offered phone service. And to be truthful, I almost never used the phone service in that. Maybe I use it twice a year, three times a year. I don't even know my own phone number because I do just use the cell phone. They're very reliable. Although I just got the town of Hempstead notice that you know they have cell sites in their cell towers in their sites, so I better make sure to keep that hard line, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, John recognized. We're going to get to him in a second. What is a 4067 or a 4066? I didn't recognize those numbers, Alan. Go ahead.
Those are just CMOS chips that I use to do switching. You basically have, I think it was 16 or 15, I think it was 0 through 15 input-output ports, and then you can control them. They're addressable through four addressable lines, A, B, C, and D, and then you put in your plus 12 and your minus, and you're ready to go.
Now, with reference to cell sites, as you probably know by looking at the last few weeks' worth of Newsday, among other newspapers, that Hempstead Town has recently come out with some extremely stiff rules with reference to new cell site installations. To my knowledge, they're not going to be applying any of those rules to the existing cell sites. People who use wireless services are always requesting more coverage, less dropouts, higher data rates, and whatever. So the number of cell sites is always less than the number that the cell company would like to provide to you. But the craziness of the rules in Hempstead Town are that they've got this 1,500-foot rule. I don't know where that number came from. In other words, you can't be any closer to a residence, a church, a daycare center, or a school than 1,500 feet with a brand-new cell site. And you follow those rules, and almost everything in the town, you can no longer put a cell site there, except maybe in the middle of a park, and there's another set of rules for that. So they're way overly restrictive. It's obviously it's going to come before a federal court, and the rule's going to be struck down. So the net result is it's just creating a grief, delay, cost, and the service that could be there is going to be occurring at a later time. John, you had a question, I think it was. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, a little comment for Alan. If it works the same way it does with Staten Island cable, what he can do is he's prepared. in an apartment for a tenant and he wants it pre-wired, and make it simple, make the location right near where you want your entrance point so they don't have to do any work, a little unscrupulous, and they will run the loop in and let the wire hang there. This way it's more advantageous for you to rent because you're going to get a tenant with cable, and it's a benefit to them. So they may do that at no cost. Try that.
Over to you, Alan.
Yeah, it's a little unscrupulous. I don't mind paying for it. I'm happy to do it. They don't have to know why I'm using it. I'm really more concerned about that than the minor cost savings. But I did think of doing it that way, saying I will have a tenant coming in soon, and this is, you know, it'd be nice to have it all ready to go when that person comes in. And that story will probably work. So I'll use that, and then everybody's happy. And they'll send me a bill, and then everyone will be happy. So that'll be that.
T2YO. Go ahead, Bernie.
Guys, I really hate it when you put me in the position of having to... Alan sees up with his amplifier, that guy could be in for a very serious fall. So this is a bad idea.
Okay, yeah. We missed some of what you said, but we did get the end of it, which was it could be a bad idea when Alan keys up with his amplifier. The amount of RF energy that a man would have on his body if he put his hand directly around the F connector on the end of a dangling piece of RG6 cable, that is the drop between Alan's house and the phone pole, the utility pole, and the end of it is unconnected, the amount of energy that the guy would get is a hell of a lot smaller than you think. The guy would send some heating in his hand right away, and he would let go of it. And that's true if Alan was running way above 100 watts, which I think he rarely does. On top of that, Alan's willing to look out the window and make sure that nobody's doing service. Yes, there was a danger involved, without a doubt. And for that reason, he's probably not going to do this. As Alan gains more and more knowledge about the way antennas work, even though he may think, he may think that his property is not big enough to contain the antennas on the low enough frequencies that he would like to go to, he's eventually going to discover that the antenna itself can be zigzagged up and down, left and right, made into spirals, have loading coils, top hat capacitors. There's a zillion ways that you can force an antenna to operate on a very small piece of real estate. I'm trying to remember the brand name of a commercial product, ham radio product, IsoLoop, I think it was Isotron. Isotron, there it is. There's an 80-meter antenna that fills up about 1 or 2 square meters of the shack.
They also make it for 160.
How about that? Now, I'm not in complete agreement with putting a kilowatt of power into an antenna that's operating a small number of feet away from your body. That's a definite situation where you should do a relatively careful calculation of relative calculation of radio frequency biohazard. But the bottom line is that you can make a high-efficiency, high-performance antenna in an extremely small package. The only thing wrong with the small antenna is that it's going to have an extremely narrow bandwidth. You QSY up the band 10KC with that Isotron, and if you're a serious user, you're going to want to retune it. You're going to operate a tuning and loading control.
They have a remote tune for it.
How about that? Give us a few words on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Isotron has a whole series of products here. Actually, Dr. Bill has one. It works very well. It doesn't have a huge amount of bandwidth, but they have a remote tuner. It's motor-driven, and, you know, it's an option for the antenna, but it'll take you from the CW end of the band all the way up to the where all the nuts are.
Now, this gets into a very frequently misunderstood area. Every day of the week, I can tune across 20 meters. Every month I can find an article in some magazine that basically comes out and says that when you make the antenna smaller in size, that yes, you can retune it in various ways to make it come back to resonance and give a fairly good impedance match to your particular narrowband. band frequency, but the efficiency will go down when you do that. Many articles say those words. The smaller antenna must have lower efficiency. Absolutely not true in general. If you use fairly resistive material, narrow diameter wires, low quality capacitors that have significant equivalent series resistance, because the amount of circulating current in the resonator section of a smaller antenna is significantly larger, yes, there is a mechanism there for greater I2R insertion loss. But if you're smart enough to use the right materials, as you make an antenna smaller and smaller, in theory, it is possible to keep the exact same gain and efficiency. That's a hard one to believe. If you understand what you're reading when you read the section of Krauss's book on antennas, a Bible on the subject, on the chapter called Infinitesimal Antenna, you can make the antenna smaller and smaller, and if you're smart enough to use the right materials and you re-resonate it, compared to a dipole, within 90-some-odd percent, it'll have the exact same gain, pattern, efficiency, everything, effective capture area. To believe that an infinitesimal antenna, let me give you an example. I start off with my comparison as a full half-wave dipole on the 75-meter band. It's a chunk of 14-gauge wire, roughly 130 feet long, with an egg insulator in the center, and I've got some kind of a ballooning device, and I'm feeding it there with a piece of coax cable. And I've got the thing suspended 40 feet in the air. It's a 130-foot-long antenna. If I do a careful study and or calculation, I'll find out that when it is receiving, it has an effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. If my eyes operated at the 75-meter band, and I look at that antenna broadside, I would see a oval-shaped black hole in space, which is about 140 feet wide and probably 40 feet high, around with that piece of wire of the dipole in the middle of it. There's an oval-shaped black hole of space, 8,500 square feet, so that when an 80-meter horizontally polarized signal comes into my neighborhood, hits that black hole, it means that that energy is being sucked up by that wire, it goes down the feed line, and moves the S-meter on my receiver. That's what the full half-wave dipole does. I now start shrinking down that dipole with loading coils and top hat capacitors and zigzagging and all the things that I can do. Instead of it being 130 feet long, I make it 30 feet long, and I could do that. And if I then carefully measured the gain of the antenna, I will get less than 1 decibel loss in gain. If I measured the efficiency of the antenna as a transmitting device or as a receiving device, it's probably going to have 96% efficiency because it's not developing any heat. Of all the 100 watts of power I put into it, 96 watts is radiated into space somewhere. The slight change in gain, the fraction of a decibel of change in gain, is because it has a slightly fatter antenna pattern. As you make the antenna... As you make the antenna physically smaller, its antenna pattern becomes a little bit broader, the broadside pattern. So in other words, the full three-dimensional pattern is a donut, and the donut gets a little bit fatter. But it can have almost the same efficiency, 30 feet long instead of 130 feet long. Now, when I QSY with that dipole, I'd have to move 150 kc before I have to do any retuning of my tuning and loading controls of my amplifier or antenna tuner. With that infinitesimal dipole, the 30-foot dipole, I tune 10 kc and I'm going to want to retune the antenna. It's a very narrowband IQ antenna. The hard part to believe is that that 30-foot long antenna, within 90-some-odd percent, 95%, has the exact same effective capture area, even though the wire is no longer filling up that black hole space that I previously described. The antenna is still doing that. That's the magic of resonance. Remember, I told you guys a whole lot of times that the way an antenna radiates is that the signal bounces back and forth between the ends of the antenna. The energy you're putting into the antenna bounces back and forth. Only a couple of percent of it is radiated on each bounce. After enough bounces, the signal finally gets radiated into space, all of it. And what you and I call resonance is to make sure that all of those bounces stay co-phase. They all stay in step with each other. And that infinitesimal dipole, the one that's only 30 feet long, the number of bounces is probably 20 times higher. And that's why you've got to work a little harder to make sure that you don't have resistive materials. Because if there's any loss in the wire, and now you're going through the wire a whole lot more times with the bouncing energy, you've got a mechanism for loss. But if you use the right materials, and the way that energy bounces back and forth, it still will all get radiated. And the law of reciprocity says, however the antenna transmits, its efficiency, its pattern, its polarization, all of the characteristics you get on transmission, you'll get the exact same
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You'll get the exact same characteristics on reception. That's what the law of reciprocity says. So the effective capture area of the antenna on reception, even though it's a physically small antenna, is essentially the same. Of course, that violates any reasonable common sense. In the case of transmitting, the signal had to bounce back and forth a whole lot of times before it finally got radiated. And it's a lot more bounces when it's a small antenna. It's a higher Q structure. In the case of reception, that signal coming in is creating all of those bounces, which somehow creates a great big magnetic field around the antenna, and it ends up with the exact same effective capture area. Ain't that magic? Opposite of common sense. None of the articles I read say anything like that, except for the left-handed way by modern standards that Krauss said it in his chapter on the infinitesimal antenna. He is saying the same thing, just that he didn't use that particular vocabulary to say it. So, therefore, if you're smart enough with electronic tuning or willing to retune the antenna every time you QSY a significant amount, there's almost no piece of property you own that isn't big enough for the antennas you desire to have. The biggest thing you care about now is the antenna high enough in the air that it gives you the elevation pattern you like so that you get the right takeoff angle, so you hit the ionosphere at the right angle, so you get the particular DX station that you want to talk to. Altitude is the only thing really left you've got to worry about. So a hell of a lot more of you guys have got a lot more capability to put up antennas than first meets the eye. Give me some call letters if you want to have a further discussion on this. K2RIW in the TechNet. Bell, we got a little bit of a space right here. Why don't we go over to your mailbag right now? We're actually getting there almost on time tonight. K2KEY. What burning questions have you had this week, Mel? And by the way, right after that, I'm going to have a quick discussion on this beautiful article that I now have a complete copy of in my hand, supplied by Charlie, W-A-2-E-G-T. He gave all of us a beautiful copy of the article. Now, I think I understand the theory of operation of your new measuring article that was in Ham Radio. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Quick question, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Don't forget to have me marked down sometime after Mel and Paul. Maybe I have my second question. Just don't forget, please.
Oh, you're on the list, John. Not to worry. There's all kinds of research going on there in Queens and Staten Island. Go ahead, Mel.
Hi, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, if you remember the discussion we had about the DTV with all the suckouts there, I have an answer for you.
Okay. That, and also I'm going to have a further discussion with you downrange about that beautiful article that was on Frontline on the subject of the great big spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Your organization did a beautiful job of indicating what's going on with BP and that oil spill and a few of the other accidents. However, I have a slight disappointment with your organization. They did a beautiful job on telling the first three quarters of the story. They didn't tell the last quarter, and I'll explain what I mean by that when we get over to you. K2KEY, go right ahead with the mailbag, Mel. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right. I'm looking through something that, you know, young people and redundant. And here's one. Yeah, this is a very interesting one, in fact, overall, that I want to put up a vertical antenna, but it's got to go on a pipe, and I know I got to guy it. And I know I've got to use galvanized wire to have an adequate guide. Can I use the galvanized wire as my radio? I got some suggestions on that, but let's hear from you. Go ahead.
Oh, I say absolutely. The ground plane radials don't necessarily have to stick straight out parallel to the ground. In many cases, there's an advantage of slanting them downward. On some of these antennas, like the K2 communication product station master, as it used to be called. It's now probably owned by some other company. Let me drop. Those ground plane radios are now tilted at about a 45 degree angle from straight out, and that gives a better impedance match. So can the ground plane radios be as the guy wire? Absolutely. Now the ground plane radios usually work best when they are approximately a quarter of a wavelength long. There's nothing stopping you from using guy wires that are longer than a quarter wavelength. And at the quarter wavelength from the mast, so to speak, you put a egg insulator and then continue with the galvanized guy wire. So therefore, electronically, it's a quarter wavelength long. Mechanically, it's as long as you want. Life gets a little bit more complicated if your physical arrangement is such that you don't have a long enough wire for the ground plane radios to be quarter wave. You can still get pretty good operation if you now use the right method of grounding the outer end of those wires. That concept has not been as well covered in the literature. You can also get around the problem by putting a loading coil inside of your ground plane radials and probably locating it close to the mast itself. Electronically, you would like the ground plane radials to be a quarter wavelength long. By way of a loading coil inside of a egg insulator that's mounted near the mast, you can make that happen. And you might end up with a greater number of guy wires because your particular design of vertical antenna would like to have four, five, or six ground plane radials. Nothing wrong with using more guy wires. You'll have redundancy in the system. So you can have your cake and eat it too with guying and having a beautiful ground plane counterpoise system by doing that, as I see it. Over to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, with these verticals, the number of them they show, they call for, like, at least four radials, you know, an elevated vertical with four radials. Using galvanized wire, you know, what about really, do we have to really think about the Q of galvanized wire versus, say, copper wire? Because I would assume that with copper wire, the Q must be many times more than galvanized wire, Dick, over.
Good guess, Mel, but I think it's nowhere near that bad. You're really asking, would I worry about the resistivity of the wire used for the counterpoise radials if I made them out of galvanized aluminum or copper? And if I was using 30-gauge wire, the answer is absolutely yes. The average guy uses guy wires at approximately 9-gauge. The Montgomery Ward catalog used to sell 9-gauge galvanized fence wire. I own quite a few rolls of it still, even after all these years. For all I know, the Montgomery Ward company no longer exists. But I used that in the early days as the guy wires for my 100-foot tower. The disadvantage of those is that the galvanizing is fairly thin, electroplated, not hot dipped, and it disappears in about 8 or so years, and the guy wire starts rusting. And so they needed replacement every 8 or 10 years or so. Whereas when you buy real Rhone, Unaco Rhone Company, as it used to be called, hot dipped galvanized quarter-inch diameter guy wire, there the galvanizing lasts for a much longer period of time. But let me drop. The resistivity of the wire is a function of only of not only what are the materials, but what is the diameter of the wire. Since what you're likely to use for guy wire is so big in diameter by electronic standards that the resistivity is going to be very low. For a person who wants to go the next step, nothing stopping you from taking a length of the wire and with various techniques measure the number of ohms per 1,000 feet or ohms per 100 feet. You can really find out what you're dealing with. Yes, I'll admit that life is a little bit more complicated because your ohm meter is going to measure what is the resistivity of the wire at DC, whereas because of that RF frequencies you get the skin effect, the RF energy only goes down the first 1/10,000th of an inch or so. And after that, that's the main reason why when you look at certain brands of foam-filled coaxial cable, hardline cable, TATV cable, for instance, quite often the semiconductor is silver or gold, here we go, copper-plated aluminum rod is the semiconductor. And the copper is there for the RF purposes, because the skin effect, that as far as the RF goes, it never goes beyond the copper. And the aluminum inside is a lighter, cheaper material, lightening up the length of the hard line. And the outer conductor is also made out of solid aluminum. They don't bother copper plating that, because the diameter, the amount of square centimeters, so to speak, of area that the RF is flowing through is so large that the resistivity of the outer conductor almost doesn't matter. You may be able to make the outer conductor out of carbon granules and still make a pretty good piece of coax cable. So I think the difference between a galvanized guy wire and a copper guy wire would be extremely difficult to measure. And you and I could come up with a couple of tests to measure the wire itself under RF conditions.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
To measure it under RF conditions. One technique would be to use the wire to make a dipole, put a given number of watts of power into the dipole, with a thermal imaging camera, look at the wire. If it has any mechanism of loss, the only mechanism of loss it has available to it is I squared R heating, something is going to be warmer. You can sense that heat by running it for a few minutes, turning off the power, and going over there and touching it with your hand. Or if you want to be scientific about it, you look at it with a thermal imaging camera, and you know exactly how many watts per foot is being dissipated on the wire. I think this is a very minor effect, Mark. Mel, here we go. Because the wire is so big in diameter, don't worry about it. Galvanizing is very good as a conductor. The only place where I think you'd run into some problems is stainless steel. Some of the alloys of stainless steel, I painfully discovered 2 years ago, has the same resistivity almost of nichrome wire, wire that's intentionally used to make a resistor. And boy, did we end up with a whole lot of loss in an antenna. And there was ways that we could have worked around that, but we weren't smart enough at the time. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech band.
AC2AZ.
AC2AZ recognized. Mark, Mel first, then we'll come over to you.
Okay, you brought up a good point, Dick, about, you know, wire that's been coated. Because of the skin effect on the guy wires, the RF current then would be flowing mostly, if it's like a zinc coating, the RF would most likely be flowing on to mostly the zinc coating. If we did, we took, say, a comparison. Let's say we made a coil, and we made equal number of turns, say, using number 14 copper wire and, say, the, all right, 14, 16 galvanized, I believe it's the galvanized steel wire is basically the what they sell for guy wire with that zinc coating on it. And we checked the Q somewhere in the HF band. What exactly would we be seeing if we did it under those control conditions, realizing that the most of the RF is going to be, I guess, concentrated in the zinc coating, over?
Yeah, as I make an antenna out of a galvanized wire, a dipole, and feed power into it, and measure the Q of the antenna, make electronic measurements of the antenna, if I was doing it with the antenna in free space, because I'm an astronaut, and I've got a small 1 cubic foot transmitter hanging at the middle of the antenna, and I hang this antenna really in free space while I'm floating in orbit, and then I back away from the antenna. Beautiful measurement. Now I take that exact same dipole, and I put it in your backyard on Dover Street, which has got a slightly salt contact in the soil, slightly conductive soil, nearby trees, houses, and whatever. All kinds of things are reflecting energy, absorbing energy, creating lost tangents and whatever. The environment the antenna is in is now going to be a fairly big contaminating factor on the electronic measurements you make on that dipole when you measure its Q and its lost tangent and its power factor and whatever. Therefore, I'm recommending the more direct approach. Put 100 watts into the antenna, key down for 10 minutes, lift up the key real fast, and go over and touch everything with your hand. you'll know immediately if anything is warm. Your hand can easily detect a couple of degrees Fahrenheit rise in an antenna. So the level of loss is very easily detected in that manner. If you want to go the next step, use the right amount of power and the thermal imaging camera. So making direct loss measurements on the wire of the antenna itself, I'd agree with. But when we put that antenna in the environment, and we get all kinds of changes in phase angles and amplitude as we sweep in frequency in the process of measuring the Q and loss tangent, oh, we're going to get a lot of contaminating factors. It'll give you a ballpark, but I think the answer is going to be very pessimistic. The environment is giving you all kinds of losses that the wire is not giving you. It's going to give you an answer a lot worse than reality, I think. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Somebody wanted to ask a question, Dick. You want to pick up that station first?
Yeah, okay. The station that just chimed in, it sounded like you said your call letters were Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Zulu. Do I have that call correct? And please give me your name and then your comment, sir. Go right ahead. My name is Dick.
Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Zulu. Dick, it's Bob. I wanted to comment, quick comment on the stainless steel stuff, and I also had a question for later. As far as the stainless steel, I had a G5RV, and it had copper, and because I didn't have 102 foot, I bent it down 65 foot on the main section and bent the ends down, and they ran through pulleys. Because of the pulleys and the hard-drawn copper, it eventually failed. I replaced it with 1/16 inch stainless steel, modeled it in 4NEC, and according to 4NEC, I lose about 1.5% power based on the resistance of the antenna. Now, I did measure it. I believe I got on half a length, 51 foot, I had about 12 ohms, which sounds like a lot. But in a dipole, you have the maximum current at the center of the dipole and minimum current at the end, so the actual loss starts dropping off as you get to the end. To make a long story short, I made this antenna, ran it through the pulleys, it works great. I haven't noticed one bit of difference, and I'm very happy with my little stainless steel antenna.
Yeah, you did say 1.5% power loss. And the nice thing to do is 1.5% power loss means that 98.5% is going in the right direction. If I take 10 times the log of 98.5%, I end up with an amount of loss of 0.06 decibels. That's, let's see, what is that? 1/15th of a single decibel. You'll never see the difference. Mother Nature's ionosphere creates QSB, where the signal you're listening to is going up and down by 10 and 20 decibels in a 1 minute period. And if you try to resolve 0.065 decibels in that period of time, I guarantee you will not be able to do it as I see it, Bob. So when it comes to insertion losses, you might, a person listening to you and I having this discussion, let me drop, might ask then, okay, where's the threshold of alarm? If I had an antenna that's throwing away 10% of its power, only 90% efficiency, I think that's one decibel of loss. And if it was throwing away 50% of the power, which sounds really terrible, that's only a 3 decibel loss, half of 1 S unit. And I could make that up by extra transmit power. And in the case of a receiving antenna on an HF frequency, the efficiency of the antenna almost doesn't matter. When I use an HF antenna on, say, for instance, 80 meters, and I'm doing a receiving operation, the noise coming in from the ionosphere, the atmosphere, all the thousands of thunderstorms and all of the power lighting noises and everything else that's going on in the environment is many decibels stronger than the signal I listen to. A very interesting experiment you can run is that if you have a precision step attenuator, put it between the feed line of your 80-meter dipole that's going into the receiver and the receiver, and plug in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 decibels of insertion loss of the precision 50-ohm step attenuator. When you do that, assuming your S-meter on your receiver is well calibrated, you'll watch the S-meter go down the appropriate amount. I mean, when you plug in 6 dB of extra loss, you'll see your S-meter go down one more S unit. But when you're listening with your ear to the signal coming out of the loudspeaker, they'll say, nothing happened. It sounds the same. What has happened is that you've made a 6 decibel insertion loss of the signal. You've made a 6 decibel insertion loss of the noise coming in on your antenna. The signal-to-noise ratio didn't change. You can use really yucky antennas.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This partially explains what happens if I take a 6-foot-long clip lead connected to the semiconductor on the UHF connector on the back end of my receiver and go listening on 80 meters. I don't get anywhere near as much S-meter deflection, but the signals I listen to sound about the same. So on receiving, you can get away with a hell of a lot of inefficiency. On transmitting, yes, it counts a lot more. That clip lead, you transmit into it, and nobody except your next-door neighbor is going to hear you, if you know what I mean, because you're competing with a whole lot of other noises on the band. And when you want to get to that DX station, yes, you'd like to have, I guess my threshold of alarm is 90%. I'd like to have a 90% efficient antenna. If I've got to spend an extra $10 to get it go from 90% to 95%, I might not spend the money, if you know what I mean. Maybe this helps a little bit, Bob. AC2AZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I hope I didn't give the impression I was worried about that 1.5%. Just the fact that the antenna doesn't come down in a heavy windstorm, the robustness of it is well worth the 1.5%. And yeah, I hear you about the attenuator, but let me ask you one thing. That applies to strong signals. When you get down towards the noise level of the receiver, doesn't that take away from the noise figure of the receiver when you start adding dBs in front of the receiver?
Good question, Bob. Unless I'm using the 10-meter band when the band is closed and it's extremely quiet, when I'm on the 80-meter band, for instance, on the average day, where the noise on the band is moving my S-meter some amount, if I did a laboratory measurement with the step attenuator, if my barefoot receiver, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air, let's assume that my barefoot receiver has a 6-decibel noise figure, which might be close to reality on an HF receiver, and I plug in a 10-decibel attenuator, leave the attenuator there, and I re-measure the noise figure of the receiver. My 6-decibel noise figure receiver just went to a 16-decibel noise figure, without a doubt. And for weak signals going straight into that receiver from a laboratory piece of equipment, I have 10 decibels less sensitivity when that attenuator is there. That's the laboratory measurement. Now I connect that antenna to my laboratory equipment, and I find out that the noise power coming into the antenna is equivalent to a 30-decibel noise figure. When my receiver goes from a 6-decibel noise figure to a 16-decibel noise figure, when it's looking at a environment coming into that antenna of a 30-decibel noise figure, if I went through all the mathematics of that, I think I would find out that the 10-decibel attenuator I put in there lowered the sensitivity of my receiver by approximately 0.05 decibels. Very, very little. It's making an impact, but a very gentle impact until the noise figure of my receiving system starts approaching the equivalent noise figure of the environment. So when you're in a noisy environment, things behave very differently. Let me give you another crazy example of this. Let me drop. Let's assume that my wife is standing in the shower, and she's alongside of a fairly noisy shower head. She's got a local source of noise, and she starts saying something to me. Are you sure you locked the door? Meaning the back door of the house. And I answer her from outside the bathroom, yes, I've locked the door, and she doesn't hear me. I mean, assuming that she and I have both the exact same hearing sensitivity, and we both talk with the exact same volume, I hear her beautifully because she's got a reasonable signal-to-noise ratio compared to the little bit of noise I get from that shower outside the room, the sound of the shower head. And so I hear her voice, and I barely hear the shower head. But in the reverse direction, you'd say, hey, reciprocity is being violated here. Not necessarily. My voice coming through to her is weaker in magnitude than the local source of noise of that shower head. She doesn't hear what I'm saying. Or she hears some garble and says, you've got to talk louder. So by the same token, When you're listening to a very noisy environment, like 80 meters with an 80-meter dipole on the average day, you can tolerate an awful lot of noise figure with a receiver in the receiving mode. But yes, you're competing with that noise when you transmit. You'd like to have all the efficiency you can get on transmit, but you can get away with murder on receiving. I wonder if that makes a little more sense of AC2AZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I have the same situation in my office. There's a bunch of fans from the environmental chillers down in the basement, and they happen to be sitting underneath my window. So I sit at my desk with my head next to the window, and I tell people to speak up as they walk into my office because they're speaking at a certain tone. They don't really hear the fans, but I hear them quite well, and so I'm speaking much louder to them. They're thinking, why am I yelling? And so forth and so on. But yes, perfectly understood. It makes sense. Low signal levels, that attenuator would cause a problem. At higher levels, it doesn't. Agreed. AC2AZM.
At higher levels of noise, it doesn't account. At first, you would say, for a weaker signal I want to listen to, that the attenuator is always going to hurt. That's sort of the opposite of what I'm saying. If the environment in which you're listening to that weaker signal happens to be a very noisy environment, and that's why you're calling it a weak signal, really meaning you're getting a very weak signal-to-noise ratio. In that environment, I can add a lot of attenuation, and you think you're attenuating the signal. At first, until you get to a ridiculously high noise figure, you're attenuating the signal and the noise by the same amount, therefore the signal-to-noise ratio doesn't change. Only when I get down to the point where the noise coming in through my system of the antenna and that attenuator, if the noise coming in from my system, from the outside world, is weaker than the local noise generated within my receiver because of its noise figure, then it hurts. Your hearing system, when you're listening to those fans, has the equivalent of a fairly high noise figure. And therefore, the weak voice of the guy standing in front of you doesn't come through quite as well. So, noise makes a big difference as to where it's coming from. Wonder if that makes a little more sense, Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I understood you. I do agree. It's when the noise and the signal levels are both high, adding that attenuator won't affect you. But now when the noise of the receiver becomes a significant portion of the noise, then yes, I agree that attenuator will affect you. I think I have that right now, don't I, AC2AZ?
Yes, you do. But if you go the next step in saying that all weak signals cannot tolerate an attenuator, if that weak signal is buried in natural noise of its own, and then you attenuate it, you may not be creating an impact to signal-to-noise ratio. As you add the attenuator, your S-meter doesn't move as far. But now if you look at the S-meter when the signal is not there, and it's S3, and the signal is there and it goes to S3.2, and you're able to barely hear the guy in sideband above, and you now start plugging in 6 dB of attenuation, and now you go from S3 down to S2 of noise, and when the signal is there, it goes to S2.2, so to speak. You have the exact same signal-to-noise ratio with the attenuator, as long as the automatic gain control of your receiver has enough range left, and as long as the environment is as noisy as it is. So this is the explanation for why I can add a yucky piece of clipweed to a receiver, which is nowhere near the right size for an 80-meter antenna, and I can go listening across the 80-meter band and hear some beautiful signals. So it's a little bit peculiar until you get into the specifics. Anybody with any further questions and comments on all of the above, give me a call that is right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY with a quick comment on
that. Don't forget the AGC.
Yeah, the automatic gain control of the receiver has got to have enough range for that to work. Mel, you had a comment? Go right ahead.
She did something in your day that I did. I guarantee that this will be very familiar. That, in fact, I still on 80 meters, 75 meters, get on with the guys and I still operate the Collins KWS1 and the 75A4. And because the noise level on 75 many times, you know, just sufficient, that riding the RF gain of the receiver just to the point where you can make intelligent conversation or hear conversation, intelligent conversation, is very beneficial. If you just bring down your RF gain, Dick. Over.
Back in the days when we used a beat frequency oscillator for Morse code reception, and then we pressed that into service for single sideband reception, cranking the RF gain control down into a beat frequency oscillator as a sideband demodulator, yes, you needed to do that for reasons of linearity and whatever. When the later days came along with a so-called product detector, which in modern-day terms is called a doubly balanced mixer, and you take a modern-day receiver listening to sideband, which has a real product detector or a doubly balanced mixer, now when you crank down the RF gain control while you're listening to a sideband signal on an HF frequency, crank down that RF gain control, depending on how it's wired. Your S meter either moves down or moves up. That's another whole discussion. Cranking down that RF gain control no longer gives you a benefit, in my opinion. On the older equipment, which was using a BFO, it made a difference. But wasn't there a period of time when Collins eventually came out with a product detector specifically designed for single sideband high fidelity reception? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Yeah, well, the Collins 7584 receiver is typical of what you just described with the product detector, and I find that moving the RF gain, controlling the RF gain, is very beneficial. And in fact, as you said back in the day, I found always that the control of the RF gain, you know, I could say the S meter, and of course many times would just pin over, and that's the end of it. But the point is that it did make for a more comfortable reception, because you just more or less got rid of a lot of the background noise and all extraneous noises, and just were able to accomplish hearing the signal, the one signal that you're listening to. I found Dick very prevalent. Over.
Yeah, now you said a mouthful. Beautiful, and that is the pumping noise in the background. When you've got a good single sideband designed receiver with a product detector, and you got a lot of excess RF gain in the receiver, and you got an automatic gain control that's going up and down, and the guy is talking to you with single sideband, during the time that he is talking, the total power coming into the receiver goes up, the S meter goes up, the automatic gain control goes down, the receiver is trying to keep the noise output to the loudspeaker approximately the same. And now that sideband guy stops talking, the receiver senses that it's getting less overall signal, automatic gain control starts opening up the gain, and now you hear a blast of noise in the background. And so that noise pumping effect is quite annoying. I think the Brits invented something called the Hung AGC system that tries to help that situation. In other words, it sort of peak detects the amount of signal, and when that signal goes away, it holds that particular automatic gain control voltage for some number of seconds downrange, waiting for the guy to start talking again before it starts opening up its gain and giving you a blast of noise. And on that particular receiver, if you don't have that Hung AGC and you turn down the RF gain enough, now you don't get that great big blast of noise and the guy stops talking. Another thing I've noticed, Mel, and you don't do as much UHF operation as I did when I had this great big high gain antenna, the 16 Yagi array, 304 total elements. Let me drop. With that particular antenna, I had a 5.5 degree main lobe beamwidth when I had it cranked up to the high gain mode. It had some relays and a phasing harness. I could decide how many antennas are in operation. Therefore, I could steer the antenna pattern electronically, and I called it a zoom control. When I was zoomed out to the high gain mode, 5.5 degree beamwidth, peaking up on a single sideband signal was very, very difficult, because as you wave the antenna back and forth, the S meter is moving up and down because of the antenna aiming at the guy, but the signal is also jumping up and down as he talks. And therefore, trying to separate which is which and when the antenna properly peaked was very difficult. If I crank down the RF gain control so that the signal, the peaks of the signal just barely went above the noise, and then I wave the antenna back and forth, and I don't look at the S meter anymore, simply use my hearing system while watching the azimuth control on the antenna positioner, And now as I sweep across 271 degrees, I recognize that his voice sounds the best, and therefore I know to go back to that azimuth setting that I'm peaked on him. So again, by setting the RF gain control low, it allows you with a very sharp antenna to properly peak on a variable signal like single sideband. Because the way the human brain measures the peaks of speech and remembers them, to make an electronic circuit do that would be very difficult. You'd be amazed how nicely the mental processing will tell you where the peak of the antenna is when you listen to a sideband signal. And even if the guy is going up and down in the way he speaks, it almost doesn't matter. Yeah. The way the brain works will still find the peak as you're waving the antenna. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech net.
Exactly. That's why Collins incorporated in most all their receivers, they have the control of the ABC line where you have off, slow, or fast. And that's exactly the reason for keeping it in the slow position, because you don't want that the receiver all of a sudden to open up, and you know, in between you get that, you know, that effect, that, and you know, that effect that you, that to blast through. So they, you know, this, I could say, is very old technology now, very obsolete technology to a great extent, but it had a lot of merit at controlling the RF gain. And in fact, similar to like you would do today, I use the attenuator. I have one of my new radios, in fact, you know, sophisticated radio, has a, I believe it's a 5-step attenuator. And, you know, just using that attenuator in many cases, yes, the signal is, of course, is reduced in gain, but the way that you copy the signal, it does go a long way to especially adjacent, close in adjacent signals. I mean, besides using the filters, but basically it goes a long way to making copy, especially on CW, a lot more easier for that particular station to take over.
I think this is another example, Mel, that as long as the receiver you've got enough knobs on the front panel, and that's a little bit of a problem with modern day equipment, there's so little front panel, you tend to have all kinds of viewing screens that get to the commands, and so it's more difficult. But if you've got a receiver with enough knobs on the front panel, there's a lot to be learned, and using all those knobs from time to time, find out what they do under various situations. There's quite often a better way that you can use your receiver than you've been using it. Probably too with the transmitter also. So, lots to be learned there. Do you want to try one more mailbag item, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Okay, yeah, because we'll be ready. We'll be losing our audience soon to a great extent. Okay, this one, this is really one that I've also seen. Is there any fact that this person wants to use PVC tubing to bring the open wire feed it in through the window through a block of wood, and you know, figures that if he drills the holes and the wood, the line it, they'll use PVC pipe. Is there a preference to the kind of PVC pipe that has anything to do with RF energy? I don't know. I've heard some stations mentioning that certain PVC pipe does have some kind of a mixture that's that you wouldn't want to enclose your vertical with. I don't know. How much good do you think that is in PVC pipe, Dick? Over.
Mel, would I be correct in assuming that the signal, the transmission line you're trying to bring through the window and through the block of wood is an open wire line, 600 ohm, 450? We're not talking about coax here. Is that true? Go ahead.
Yeah. In a case like I have feed through right through the wall, but I use those ceramic oil burner igniters as my feed through. In other words, I have 600 ohm wires soldered outside the feed through, drilled through the wall, but precisely drilled so that they fit fairly snug and seal them both sides. But in other words, a lot of people with double hung window or something, you know, don't want to drill holes. So they put a one of these blocks in there, these aluminum blocks they can get. I know they sell those aluminum blocks that, you know, you can adjust for different window widths. And then if you're going to use 600 ohm feed-throughs, well, they got a couple of suggestions. They tell you about feed-through, old-fashioned feed-through ceramic insulators or If you want to make your own, roll your own. The use of PVC pipe. Now, is there a PVC pipe that is better when it comes to RF exposure? Or I don't know. I've heard talk that certain PVC pipe is not good for around RF situations. Over.
Okay, I've got the picture of bringing open wire line into a house and where the wire itself goes through the house. You're smart enough to use those porcelain insulators that are used for an oil burner igniter circuit, and they're rated for a bare minimum of 10,000 volts AC. You'll never arc over one of those. They're very low-loss C-type ceramic material. C-type, I think is what it's called, but anyhow, it's a ceramic white material. And so that's the Cadillac approach. PVC, I can see various chemicals you can put into the PVC that, in the presence of RF, would create some loss. But here, the insertion loss is not too difficult to evaluate, Mark, now, Mel, and that is by using the conservation of energy. Let me drop. If, for instance, you think that your, let me put a number in here, 0.05, okay, got to turn the machine on first, 0.05, negative, anti-log, good, 1 minus, there we are. If I was running 100 watts of power from my transmitter, and if the PVC pipe where my open wire line is going through is creating half a decibel of loss, that's my threshold of alarm here, half a decibel of loss, which really means that 10.9% of my power is being heated up, it lost as heat. I could measure that fairly easily. I'm running a 100-watt transmitter, 10% is being lost, 10 watts is being dissipated into that PVC. If I ran that transmitter key down for anything more than about 60 seconds, if that PVC is dissipating 10 watts of the 100 watts I'm putting through it, boy, I'm going to feel that heat immediately, and I'm going to know about it. Turn up the transmitter, go over there, and touch the PVC in all the places where I can get to it. If the PVC runs ice cold when I'm running 100 watts through it, that means the insertion loss, whatever it is extremely small compared to half a dB. Maybe it's 0.005 dB, and I can stop worrying about it. So there is no loss mechanism in a dielectric material that I know about that doesn't show up as heat. That's the only mechanism by which you lose power. If it runs cold, it's good. So when in doubt, measure the heat. K2KEY, K2RIW, good old conservation of energy.
Yeah, you brought up a good point. Yeah, those feed through those white, I believe they're porcelain that they use in the oil burner system. Now, question. If you use feed through, as any of the polycarbonates, you know, like PVC or Lexan or any of those, are any of them in any way not suggested safe use, that they can't be used safe for insulators? I see them making, you know, the old dog bone insulators that were made out of glass, or the ones that were made out of, like I say, the old white porcelain. Now you see them made out of a thing, I guess they call it Delrin, Dick, over.
Yeah, ultraviolet protected Delrin, a black plastic-like material, is a very good RF material. It's used as the shoulder bushings on insulated Yagi elements. The 432 Yagi RIW-19, it used ultraviolet protected Delrin shoulder bushings with keepers on the left and right side of the boom of the antenna, and the element went through all of that, and it ran ice cold. Let's do it reverse thinking here, Mel. If I wanted to find an insulating material that goes through the window, like those PVC pieces of tubing, or that I'm using it for egg insulators or whatever, and if I wanted to intentionally lose power, I wanted to make it lossy, what would I do? What material would I choose? And the extreme case of that problem is when you're building the absorbing material on the walls of an anechoic chamber. What do they do in that case? And in the case of the pyramid-shaped absorbing cones made by the Emerson Cumming Company, that's used on chambers for many decades. Let me drop.